supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
There's plenty of reaction to controversial comments made by Pennsylvania Senate Education Committee Chair John Eichelberger. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. At a town hall meeting last week, he suggested that, quote, inner-city students would be better served by being held to a lower academic bar. Let's get up to speed with Keystone Crossroads education reporter Kevin McCory. Kevin, first off, review what happened at that town hall.
Sure. So Eichelberger is a conservative Republican who represents a largely rural area between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh. That includes Altoona. He had a town hall meeting last week where the subject of education policy pretty much dominated the discussion. And there was a local newspaper there, The Sentinel, out of Carlisle, reporting on the meeting. And then they wrote that he said that money was being misspent on pushing minority students from high school into college instead of into vocational programs. And then as the article was shared, some of Eichelberger's Democratic counterparts reacted pretty angrily, including State Senator Vincent Hughes, who represents parts of Philadelphia and Montgomery County. And he says this shows that Eichelberger is unfit to be education chair.
The fact that we have to go back to and address this issue at a root level, based on his statements, is outrageous, is sad, and it represents the times that we're in right now.
So Eichelberger declined to speak with me, instead offering a statement through a spokesman in which he says he's committed to ensuring that every student has a chance to succeed regardless of skin color or economic status. And he since wrote about the situation on his website, saying that the Sentinel story was, quote, dishonest, and the story has been spun into, quote, fake news by Democrats and the liberal media outlets.
Fake news, you say? That's quite the loaded term in this political climate. We're able to chase that down.
Well, I did reach out to the Sentinel, and they defended the accuracy of their reporting. And since Eichelberger declined to speak with me further about it, I couldn't really get a more nuanced view of his thinking, what he said, what he didn't, from his point of view. But I was able to speak with one of his constituents, who was also at the town hall. Adam Oldham is a high school guidance counselor and registered Republican.
He seemed to be expressing frustration that too many kids are going to college unprepared and aren't getting anything to show for it except college debt. And that's a very real frustration. He did take it one step farther, and I don't know why he chose to talk about inner city kids versus just kids in general, but he chose to talk about inner city kids and inner city schools and how they specifically seem to push their kids into college where they go and they fail. And we need to push them more into vocational training and trade schools where, you know, it's more on their level, which comes across in a very particular way. And I think the reaction we're seeing to some of that thinking is warranted.
The other thing to point out here, Dave, is that there's a more nuanced discussion needed about school funding that it seems to me Eichelberger isn't addressing. So if we're talking about school funding to urban districts, we have to note that the state sends less money per student to some of its biggest urban districts, such as Philadelphia, Lancaster, Erie, Scranton, and Wilkes-Barre, than it does to many, many other districts, including much wealthier ones. And that includes many of the school districts represented by Eichelberger. And even if you just look at his districts, Altoona is the poorest, most urban district, and it gets less state funding per child than most of his others. And this all goes back to the fact that the state's method for distributing education funding isn't really based on student need.
Kevin, who else are you hearing from on this dispute?
Well, I specifically reached out to some urban charter school leaders because in theory, because Eichelberger is a big proponent of school choice, there's a natural commonality there. But when statements like this one we're discussing come up, it does raise a lot of skepticism. Sharif Elmeki is a principal at Mastery Shoemaker Charter School.
When people say, oh, I'm pro-choice and I'm all about school choice and charters and things like that, yet funding that's being distributed does not speak that same language of equity. And you have to ponder, like, what's their real rationale and what's their real purpose, and are they really committed to equity and justice in our educational systems in Pennsylvania?
Kevin, any reaction from Philadelphia School Superintendent William Hite?
He declined to comment. Top Senate leaders, though, say this story is being blown out of proportion, and they say they continue to have faith in Eichelberger as education chair. And meanwhile, Vincent Hughes says he's strategizing with his allies about possibly removing him from the post.
Let's note that Eichelberger ran unopposed for re-election in 2010. We'll see if that's the case this time around. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Kevin McCrory on Newsworks Tonight. On the campaign trail last year, President Donald Trump promised to get rid of many regulations, especially those designed to protect the environment. One of those regulations has to do with very small bodies of water. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on the Waters of the U.S. rule and the fight over how far those protections should extend.
When the Clean Water Act passed in 1972, it defined waters that would need some special protection from pollution as, quote, navigable. For most of us, that means big enough to float a boat. But over the years, it became clear that smaller streams and wetlands needed protection from pollution as well, especially those that feed into larger rivers and lakes, which provide drinking water.
Basically, all parties have agreed that it doesn't strictly mean navigable anymore.
Owen McDonough is with the National Association of Home Builders, one of the industry groups seeking clarity on which tiny bodies of water do need protection.
We're not talking about, for instance, things like the Susquehanna River, the Chesapeake Bay.
What they are talking about are smaller headwater streams, or tiny streams where water does not flow constantly. Those murky areas that are sometimes land, sometimes water. Over the years, Congress tried and failed to clarify the rule. Past administrations tried and failed as well. And the courts seemed to just add to the confusion over which of these tiny waterways deserved protection from discharges and runoffs, and which of them didn't. In 2015, the Obama administration tried once and for all to define exactly what deserved a federal permit and what didn't. But it also failed, garnering criticism from the oil and gas industry, builders, and farmers who all think it goes too far.
The stitches dry on my farm today, not a puddle anywhere. There's no water flowing, but the government doesn't care.
In this Farm Bureau ad, a farmer's wife sings about the rule as a video shows her running through fields barefoot in a white dress.
With a brand new rule, they want to regulate us more.
The Farm Bureau began what they called the Ditch the Rule campaign, criticizing the regulation as causing even more confusion for farmers who feared they would need a permit to discharge into every ditch or puddle on their farm. Don Parrish with the American Farm Bureau Federation says the EPA did a bad job listening to their concerns.
I think as much as anything, they actually belittled a lot of farmers' concerns. You know, the administrator called some of our concerns silly and ludicrous.
Parrish says the threats to farmers are very real, because not getting a permit carries heavy fines or even jail time. But the EPA said the new rule would not impact farmers and ranchers and would actually help protect the farmers' water. The agency said the waters covered by the new rule are expanding just 3 to 5%. Ellen Galinsky worked for the EPA under Obama, where she advised on the Waters of the U.S. rule.
I had the opportunity to go all over the country visiting farmers and ranchers in New England, out west, in the south, and actually walk their fields and ask them, you know, what are you worried about?
Galinsky, who now works as an environmental consultant, said EPA did a bad job explaining the new rule.
And they would point to certain features and say, oh my God, we're not going to be able to clean out this ditch. We're not going to be able to do this. We're not going to be able to do that. And I would say that's not true.
Galinsky says farmers and ranchers have exemptions from many provisions of the Clean Water Act. But she says it's important that others don't.
So many of our waterways receive pollutants from sewage treatment plants, from discharges from industry that are small streams. And can you imagine if those weren't regulated, if you didn't require permits for those discharges, you'd have a lot of water pollution.
But the Farm Bureau says nothing in the new rule guaranteed those exemptions. And builders who don't have exemptions didn't like what the EPA came up with either. Again, Owen McDonough with the Home Builders Association.
So you can think about farm field in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, that is changing hands from longtime farmer now to a builder and developer. And that builder and developer is all of a sudden faced with a property that has jurisdictional waters of the United States on it.
McDonough says builders have to spend a lot of money hiring environmental consultants to help secure permits. And now they have a powerful ally.
Regulations are horrible. What's happening with regulations? Horrible.
That's fellow builder President Trump speaking to the Home Builders Association last August. Trump's new EPA chief, Scott Pruitt, sued the agency when he was Attorney General of Oklahoma over the Waters of the U.S. rule. Pruitt is expected to scrap what the Obama administration did and start from scratch. No matter what action the Trump administration takes on these smaller waterways, though, the heart of the Clean Water Act, which protects all bodies of water, isn't going anywhere. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Travelers on a budget may be intrigued by basic economy airfares. Well, they should also don their reading glasses to check out the fine print. And for that, let's turn to George Hobica, founder of AirfareWatchdog.com. George, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Dave, I'm excited to share all the ins and outs with your listeners because it is a bit confusing.
It seemed so much simpler when the options were first class or coach. What's led to this trend for an almost infinite variety of fare pitch points?
I think the airlines are taking a lesson from hotels where obviously there are the grand suites and different brands of hotels. You know, you've got the Staybridge Suites and the Econo Lodges, and then you have the Ritz-Carltons. You know, the same thing with theaters and sports venues. I mean, there are the great seats and there are the poor seats. It used to be that everyone paid the same price for a different experience. Some people sat in the front of the plane in a window or an aisle seat, and they paid the same price or perhaps even less than somebody in the middle seat at the back of the plane. And I guess the question is, was that fair, no pun intended, or not?
Though specific to airlines, it seems that over the past decades, discount carriers have been expanding, taking business away from the so-called legacy airlines.
Yes, interesting fact that American Airlines has provided 87% of their passengers only buy an airfare once a year. So there are two things about that. One thing is they're very inexperienced in finding airfares. And the other thing is they're probably just price conscious. So what's been happening is Spirit and Frontier and Allegiant have been siphoning off some of those that long tail of travelers, those once-a-year travelers, but there's a lot of them. And American, United, and Delta have taken notice, and they said, you know, we want some of those travelers to come back. We actually have a better product, which they do. We have more frequencies. We have better planes than Allegiant has. And we don't want to lose this customer, this once-every-year customer.
Until the customer gets to the airport, and then the features or the lack thereof of the basic economy airfare kicks in, like you can't bring luggage onto the plane or you have to pay extra for an overhead compartment.
Well, this is what I'm afraid of, Dave, especially these once-in-a-blue-moon travelers. They're not going to realize what hit them. And what's going to hit them is, well, for one thing, the middle seat. They are only going to get the middle seat. They cannot choose an aisle or a window seat. At least on Frontier and Spirit, you can choose a seat for a fee. On some of these major carriers now, Delta, United, and American, you cannot even have the option of choosing a seat. You're going to be in the middle seat if you buy one of these fares. And except on Delta, you are not allowed to use the overhead bin. Now, the exciting part is going to be who is going to police the use of the overhead bin.
Post 9/11, the understandable security delays, and then learning that airlines are reporting record profits helped by falling oil prices, there can't be much sympathy for the entire experience of getting from A to B on a plane.
The good thing about getting from A to B is it's safe. So let's give credit where credit is due to the U.S. airline industry. It's an incredibly safe product. It's safer than it's ever been. In addition, they are buying new planes. They are modernizing the baggage handling systems. They are improving their terminals. And this is for everyone, not just their Uber flyers, the business travelers. They are using some of that profit also to give back to employees who have really been suffering during the years that the airlines lost billions of dollars. And that does make for a happier employee, and that's going to make for a happier passenger. So, yeah, they are earning billions of dollars, and there's very little sympathy. On the other hand, all these other airlines are coming in, WOW, Norwegian, Emirates, Etihad, Qatar, and taking away some of the premium customers and some of the international customers. And they are giving the U.S. carriers a run for their money.
So to what extent is the basic economy fare truly a bargain?
In most cases, you're only saving about $50 round trip on the routes that the airlines have announced so far. Now, they may announce routes that are longer in duration, and maybe the fare difference will be greater. But so far, the fare difference is about $40 or $50. And if you're going to check a bag, you're going to pay $50 to check that bag. So it's not worth it.
George, thanks so much for shedding light on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure. Anytime.
George Hobick, a founder of AirfareWatchdog.com. This weekend, the Barnes Foundation opens an exhibition extending beyond the walls of its gallery on the Parkway in Philadelphia. The show, called Person of the Crowd, is about art that directly engages the life of city streets. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on the art of flannery.
Flannery dates back to the mid-19th century when artists, mostly in London and Paris, would aimlessly wander the streets to passively absorb whatever the city offered. Curator Tom Collins designed the Barnes Foundation's temporary exhibition space to reflect the visual and sonic cacophony of the city. The pieces in Person of the Crowd are by modern flaneurs since the 1950s, when many artists rediscovered the street as a canvas. For example, Puerto Rican artist Papo Colo in 1977 ran naked to the waist along New York City's West Side Highway. He was dragging scraps of wood that represented the congressional rejection of Puerto Rico's statehood. In 2001, Jefferson Pinder shot video of himself running half-naked through the blighted streets of Baltimore. Collins says these artists updated the flaneur concept from a century earlier.
It's possible by the late 1950s for women and people of color to be flaneur, which it was not possible in the 19th century for a whole variety of social, political, and economic reasons.
A big part of the show is what does not happen inside these walls. The Barnes commissioned several artists to create actions on the streets of Philadelphia during this exhibition. One of those artists is Ayanna Evans, who will perform rather mundane tasks like running up the rocky steps, jumping rope, crashing the cheesesteak lines at Pasinginos. But she's doing it while wearing an outlandishly skin-tight bodysuit in a neon yellow zebra print with 4-inch patent leather heels. Evans has been doing this for a few years in New York, and she calls it the Cat Suit Project.
I would just crash openings, actually. I would just show up in this outfit. Listeners should know I'm very curvy. So if I was skinny, then there would probably be no reaction, right? But it's like you crashed, you're black, and you got this huge butt, and you have the nerve to wear neon and zebra print.
Like her predecessors, black men who ran half naked through a blighted urban environment, Evans' Cat Suit Project is not so much about her action than about spectators watching her do that action. All the actions performed as part of the exhibition will be documented online at personofthecrowd.com. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
And finally this evening, the borough of Bristol in Pennsylvania is celebrating tonight. This after being proclaimed winner of the Small Business Revolution Main Street Project. Started by Deluxe Corporation, a company offering marketing and financial services to small businesses, the Small Business Revolution is a contest whereby towns across the country vie for a $500,000 revitalization. After receiving some 14,000 nominations, Deluxe selected five finalists and then left it to the internet to vote on their favorite. Bristol's self-proclaimed gritty personality won the popular vote, putting it ahead of Georgetown, South Carolina, Kingsburg, California, North Adams, Massachusetts, and Red Wing, Minnesota. In a video announcing the winner, Deluxe's chief brand and communications officer, Amanda Brinkman, offers a message of optimism to the runners-up.
You have come together as a community and reminded each other what you love about where you live. You've supported your small businesses. You've gotten the word out in social media. Keep that momentum going.
Bristol Borough's revitalization will include marketing services, business advice, and support from Deluxe. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov. Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. The federal government is planning to step up immigration enforcement against unauthorized residents, and tomorrow evening we'll meet some Philadelphians who are training to disrupt those deportations. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.